Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is ew.com. Let's get started with our must list, because I have at least one pretty long article I think I'm going to use up all the time this week. Netflix drama Pulse, Michelle Williams' dramedy Dying for Sex, and some freaky tales top this week's must list. A new play directed by Felicia Rashad and Glenn E. Freeman's A Book of Photos of Punk Band Bad Brains round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I don't know that any cast gets along as well as the young Hollywood stars of Warfare. Getting to experience that brotherhood firsthand at their Entertainment Weekly cover shoot was a joy, and I hope at least a fraction of that energy shines through in the photos, video, and story we posted earlier this week ahead of their A24 film about an Iraq war battle and the Navy SEALs who lived it, hitting theaters April 11th. That's Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first item on our must list is Pulse. If you love hospital dramas but find The Pitt too stressful and Grey's Anatomy too soapy, this Netflix drama from Zoe Robin and Carlton Cuse may just be what the doctor ordered. Sorry. When brilliant resident Danny Sims, played by Willa Fitzgerald, meets her handsome chief resident Xander Phillips, played by Colin Woodell, sparks fly, but their resulting relationship is a lot more complicated and interesting than the show's trailer makes it seem. Blending high-stakes medical drama with a dose of romance and a nuanced look at workplace power dynamics, Pulse ensures you'll never look at the Meredith-McDreamy relationship the same. Dying for Sex is next. This Hulu limited series follows best friends Molly, played by Michelle Williams, and Nikki, played by Jenny Slate, after the former learns her cancer is back and incurable. This is a truly unique television experience that will have you sobbing one second and cackling the next. Next we have Freaky Tales. This bloody, bold, and a bit bonkers film lives up to its title, weaving together four stories set in 1987 Oakland and headlined by stars including Pedro Pascal, Jay Ellis, and Normani. Come for the freaky, stay for Ellis's show-stopping finale. Fearless Vampire Killers, The Bad Brains Photographs. The Bad Brains are one of the most important and influential bands ever, and photographer Glenn E. Friedman captured them in all their punk glory as they were first making their mark in dingy clubs and basements. This photo book honors the Black Rock pioneers with almost every image he shot of the group. And last we have Purpose. Brandon Jacobs Jennings' searing Broadway portrait of a famous Black family on the brink brings both laughs and gasps, especially around the dinner table. Felicia Rashad directs performances that are uniformly excellent, but a special shout-out to Alana Arenas, who is remarkable as the in-law who only wants out. That's our must list this week. A Netflix drama, Pulse, Michelle Williams' dramedy Dying for Sex, and some freaky tales top this week's must list. That was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. We have a movie review about Minecraft, the Minecraft movie. Jason Momoa mines gold in surprisingly well-crafted adaptation. The title suggests more movies in the Minecraft universe. Bring 'em on! This is by Jordan Hoffman. The studio releasing a Minecraft movie decided to screen for critics on a Sunday morning only. You might think, who cares? You're seeing a movie for free. Some of us actually work for a living. And that's totally fair. Plus, a weekend option is good for family films if you want to bring kids. But know that this threw an obstacle the size of an iron golem into my schedule So when I got to the theater, I sat in the very back row, as close as possible to the exit, and kept my windbreaker zipped and my arms crossed. Then, about 15 minutes later, I found myself cracking up and cheering on the dopey ragtag team of adventurers trapped in the overworld. So, if that isn't proof that the Jack Black and Jason Momoa-led film based on the colossally popular video game franchise has some charm, I don't know what is. The setup blazes by during a prologue. A fella named Steve, played by Black, is bored with his life in a small town in Idaho. Yes, their primary industry is potato-related. He yearns to go to the mines and build things. But when he does, he somehow finds himself in a magical realm that ought to look familiar to anyone who plays Minecraft. Soon he has possession of a magic orb, but it looks like a cube because everything here is squared off, making for a nice recurring gag, and is prisoner of the creativity-hating pig creature, Malgosha, voiced by Rachel House. A series of shenanigans sends the orb back to the real world, where it is found by Garrett, the garbage man Garrison, down on his luck, former video game champ, played by Momoa, in full Danny McBride mode. With him is an awkward, curly-haired preteen with a slight speech impairment, Henry, played by Sebastian Hansen, his new-to-adulthood guardian and older sister, Natalie, played by Emma Myers, and the fun real estate agent and traveling zookeeper, Don, played by Danielle Brooks. Everyone ends up in the Land of the Lost, where the sheep are square, and if you throw bricks, you can build bridges and even fly if you know what you're doing. The plot is absolutely secondary to the zingy dialogue, action beats, creative look of the film, and the good-natured shouting. Much like Barbie, this is a cart-before-the-horse type of movie, driven initially by market forces, not creative impulses. Minecraft, more so than most games, really doesn't lend itself to a narrative story. Its whole purpose is that it is a free-form system of play. But it's also one of the last major intellectual properties not yet mined, for a feature film. So there's a kind of cynical inevitability to this. Knowing there are 5 credited screenwriters adds to the understandable skepticism, but just as Minecraft players can build the unexpected out of disparate elements, bringing in an unexpected director helped craft this thing the right way. Jared Hess, co-creator of Napoleon Dynamite and a string of other small oddball pictures, brings a fresh perspective to what could have been a lumbering IP-palooza movie. He's never worked in a budget range like this, and quite frankly, a lot of other films. Did you see Gentleman Broncos or Don Verdeen? Are extremely annoying. But by some force of alchemy, his cockeyed look at things, a mix of deadpan delivery, garish colors, and exaggerated interactions, is weirdly perfect for this adaptation. There's an anything-goes attitude here, but within the basic borders of a group of people zip off to Oz and need to get home framework, this loosey-goosey attitude, an open sandbox, if you will, is a breath of fresh air after so many family films that seem preordained by lore. It may have been a financial success, but the most recent Sonic the Hedgehog picture is particularly lifeless. Minecraft might be the most played video game out there, but good luck trying to determine what it is with a simple search. As a non-player myself, I can attest to this. The message of the movie is, I suppose, that it is important to be creative and that the world needs dreamers. That's nice, but the real fun is watching Momoa do the tough guy who is actually a big lunkhead routine. And while this isn't anything too new, see several notches in the resumes of Dave Bautista or Dwayne Johnson or even the mighty Arnold Schwarzenegger himself. Momoa's comic timing is particularly sterling in a Minecraft movie. He's doing extremely good work here, seriously. Broad comedy is not easy. The rest of the cast is also quite good. Young Sebastian Hansen nails the Wes Anderson-esque hip-to-be-square vibe. Danielle Brooks is a fountain of sass, and while it took me a good long while to clock it, Emma Myers has a daffy energy that reminded me of Beth Howland from TV's Alice, which is a compliment. Yes, that's an extremely Gen X reference, but I just watched a Minecraft movie. Please cut me some slack. The weak link, oddly, is Jack Black, whose high fructose delivery can get a little irritating after a while. His opening voiceover has some of the audible panic of someone asked to watch after someone else's kids, laying on the excitement really thick in hopes they don't notice mommy and daddy have stepped away for a few minutes. Director Hess gives Black carte blanche to stomp around the frame, and unless you are a card-carrying member of his fan club, you might wish for a little more restraint. But the look of the picture is a lot of fun. None of the villains in this PG-rated picture are anything but cute, and that includes the zombie creatures that attack at night. As far as Minecraft in-jokes, I'm sure there are many. My audience of kids got very excited. Some even shouted, "Uh-oh!" when a walking cactus tree appeared. Research tells me that this is a creeper. Maybe seeing it on a Sunday morning was the best idea after all. That's a Minecraft movie review. Jason Momoa mines gold in surprisingly well-crafted adaptation. That was by Jordan Hoffman, who is giving the movie a grade of B. For television, White Lotus Season 3 is wrapping up in the next episode as I'm reading this. So here is who dies in the White Lotus Season 3. Here are our favorite theories ahead of the finale, including a rogue monkey with a gun. Who dies? Who pulls the trigger? And what does the finale's title mean? This is by Randall Colburn. There is a spoiler alert on this article, but I've read through it and I've seen the season so far. I don't think there's really a lot of spoilers here, other than one from season 2, which is pretty big, but if you've been watching the show, you already know about that one. The White Lotus has a little something for everybody. Drama, comedy, weird sex, and mystery. Even if you're not into its cerebral monologues and layered themes of class, privilege, and identity, you can always spend the season theorizing about who dies. Somebody always ends up in a body bag. Set in Thailand, season 3 features roughly a dozen central characters, including Belinda, played by Natasha Rothwell, a season 1 fan favorite at odds with John Grease's Greg, or is it Gary, who may have been involved in the death of her would-be benefactor Tanya, played by Jennifer Coolidge. Going into this Sunday's finale, Belinda must decide whether she'll take a payoff from Greg and stay silent about his whereabouts or follow her conscience. But what about the other storylines? How will the financial crimes of Southern elite Timothy, played by Jason Isaacs, impact his family? Will Rick, played by Walton Goggins, face repercussions for his revenge mission? Is the dalliance between Leslie Bibb, Carrie Coon, and Michelle Monaghan's trio of friends and some shady Russian dudes going to be a problem? And what about the hapless security guard, Guy Tuck, played by Tammy Thapdenthong, and the gun he absolutely should not have been given? Here are some White Lotus Season 3 finale theories to consider ahead of Amor Fati, the 8th and final episode. Death will bring peace. If there's one idea that the White Lotus Season 3 has proposed, it's that death can be its own kind of peace. After all, many characters that came to Thailand this season were searching for peace, but instead found chaos, strife, and anxiety. Rick, for example, has spent his entire vacation irritable, lashing out at Chelsea, played by Amy Lou Wood, and fretting over his planned confrontation with Jim, played by Scott Glenn, the White Lotus owner he believes murdered his father. Meanwhile, Timothy learned he's wanted for financial crimes back home and that his family's elevated lifestyle could fall apart the moment they returned to the States. Since then, he's wandered through the resort in a lorazepam-induced haze, dreaming about murdering his family and then himself. We know someone, or maybe someone's, will die in the season finale, but series creator Mike White might paint their death as less of a tragedy than a relief. After all, the monk that Piper, played by Sarah Catherine Hook, longs to study under, described death as a happy return to home. And the finale's title, Amor Fati, is a Latin phrase that translates to love of fate. Put simply, philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche interpret it as a path to true happiness, an embrace of all things good and bad, including suffering. Only great pain is the ultimate liberator of the spirit, Nietzsche wrote in 1882's The Gay Science. Who is going to die in the White Lotus Season 3 finale? Here are their guesses or their options. The Ratcliffes. The most prominent theory involves the Ratcliffe family and the poisonous fruit growing outside their villa. In the first episode, the family's health mentor told them to stay away from it, saying the fruit is poisonous and could potentially kill anyone who ingests it. The finale teaser reminds us that locals call it the suicide tree. Unsurprisingly, Timothy, who's been dreaming of shooting Victoria, played by Parker Posey, and Saxon, played by Patrick Schwarzenegger, whilst wandering through the grounds like a ghost, picks one of the fruits with a curious look on his face. Later in the teaser, we see a blender whirring, a callback to Saxon's love of protein shakes and his routine efforts to get Sam Nivola's Lachlan to drink one. The obvious takeaway here is that Timothy will use the fruit to poison his family, like through a protein shake. But is it too obvious? And what about those gunshots in the first episode's opening sequence? Belinda is next as a guess. Lest we forget it, it was Belinda's son Zion, played by Nicholas Duvernay, we saw in the season's opening flash forward. He was in a meditation session when the shots rang out, and he seemed to be running right into the line of fire. Combine that with Belinda possibly rejecting Greg's offer. "I'm not doing this," she says. "It's a waste of time." And things aren't looking good. That, however, would be a touch too obvious and pretty cruel, which really isn't the White Lotus way. There tends to be a bit of pitch-black comedy wrapped up in the deaths. See Tanya toppling to her death after escaping her would-be murderers in Season 2. Also, when Zion sees a body floating near him, he swims away from it. If it were his mother, whom he's clearly very concerned about, you'd think he'd swim toward the body. We're thinking this scenario is unlikely. The next scenario is Rick. Somebody with a huge bullseye on his back? Rick, who pretended to be a film producer to weasel his way into the home of Jim and Sritala, played by Lek Patravati, and confront Jim over potentially murdering his father. Though Rick didn't shoot Jim with the gun from his old friend, Frank, played by Sam Rockwell, he did knock the old man out of his chair before fleeing with Frank into Bangkok. You don't do that to someone as rich and, per Jim's telling, as dangerous as Jim. Based on the teaser, it looks like Rick returns to the resort, which is a bold move considering he just attacked its owner. "I'm going to be okay," he tells Chelsea, and Yeah, his soul might be. The final shot of him in last Sunday's episode, after all, saw him looking more peaceful than he has all season. But inner peace won't prevent Jim from going after the guy at his resort who attacked him. Maybe, though, Rick has achieved amor fati. Chelsea. God help us if Chelsea gets caught in the crossfire, but we'd be remiss not to look at the evidence. Bad things come in threes, she intoned earlier this season, and while she was worried about harm befalling Rick, it could speak to something much darker for the world's best girlfriend. Chelsea was held at gunpoint earlier in the season by the jewelry store thieves, who we now know were Valentine's Russian roustabouts, and then she was bitten by a snake due to Rick's own drug-induced carelessness. Could the third bad thing be her untimely death? Lord, protect this woman at all costs. Mook. White Lotus employee Mook, played by Lalisa Manobal, has been a bright and welcoming presence this season, but not a particularly vital one. But hey, the finale might change that. One of the more tragic theories is that her encouraging Guy Tuck to be ruthless might result in her taking a stray from his own gun. This doesn't feel right, but anything is possible. And we have Gary, or Greg. Justice for Tanya? Okay, then who's shooting the gun? The possibility here is Guy Tuck. We've seen a few guns this season, but the most prominent one belongs to Guy Tuck, the world's worst security guard, who we still hope finds love with Mook. After his boss gave him the gun, Guy Tuck finds out that Timothy stole it. He eventually got it back, but not before instilling a sense of absolute doom in the audience. It's like watching a toddler running with a knife in their hand. Heading into the finale, Guy Tuck could end up pointing that gun in a couple of different directions. The teaser trailer alludes to a potential showdown between Guy Tuck and Valentine, played by Arnas Fedorovicius, who was connected to the jewelry heist that previously put Guy Tuck in hot water. But Guy Tuck could also be tasked by Jim and Sritala with apprehending Rick once he steps back onto White Lotus grounds. There's Greg or Gary, either one, whoever he is. The White Lotus's resident big bad Gary, formerly known as Greg, is obviously a suspect given his unsavory past and menacing aura. But would someone as rich as Greg really pull the trigger? You'd think if he wanted Belinda dead, he could find a less public and bloody way than shooting her in plain sight. The Russians. This also seems unlikely. Why would Valentine's pals return to the scene of the crime with guns? But it's worth throwing out the possibility since we know that they're armed. Also, we hear enough shots in episode 1's flash forward that there could absolutely be more than one shooter. We have Chloe. Wait, Chloe, played by Charlotte Le Bon, the ex-model who's dating Gary Gregg, the one who had a threesome with the two brothers? Yep. This theory comes courtesy of Reddit user Minion, and by virtue of it incorporating Simpsons lore, it's too good not to share. Chloe previously appeared to be wearing a necklace with a charm of Maggie Simpson, who famously pulled the trigger in the 1995 two-parter Who Shot Mr. Burns? Hey, if you squint, Gary Gregg looks a bit like Mr. Burns. Just saying. A subtle hint or a red herring? And we have Frank. The other gun that played a key role this season belongs to Frank, an old associate of Rick's who went sober, found Buddhism, and promptly fell off the wagon after getting roped in to Rick's scheme. Rick didn't shoot Jim with it during their confrontation, though he did brandish it, and he threw it out once he and Frank were back on the streets of Bangkok. Rick seems at peace without it, but that doesn't mean Frank didn't go back for it. No longer sober, he's begun to exude a recklessness, and the teaser includes a shot of him knifing a pillow. All of this is to say that Frank could be the finale's wild card. And other possible shooters, the monkeys. A theory that's been making the rounds on social media since the premiere: one of the monkeys got a gun. Crazier things have happened. Monahan already debunked this idea in an interview with In Style, but it's so delightfully absurd we couldn't help but mention it anyway. What? The monkeys do the shooting? Man, y'all have lost it, she said. Spoiler alert, the monkeys don't do the shooting. A few more stray theories. Is Mook in cahoots with the Russians? It's clear that Valentin is in league with the Russians who robbed the resort, but could Mook also be complicit? Fans have been bandying this theory around for weeks, and her reaction to Gaituk staring them down at the Muay Thai fight could give it a bit more credence. We're skeptical. Will Saxon be the only Ratliff to grow? When we met Saxon, he was the ultimate bro, crowing about pumps, protein, and sex while making uncomfortable jokes and, masturbating in front of his siblings. Though Piper and Lachlan were initially posited as Ratliff's golden children, they've both proven themselves to be lacking a certain moral character. Piper's interest in Buddhism seems less rooted in a love for the culture than a means of sticking it to her parents, while Lachlan has proven himself to be eerily invested in making the ancestral undercurrents of his relationships with Saxon and Piper a reality. Saxon, meanwhile, is a bit too dumb to be so cunning. His insecurities have manifested in several moments of self-awareness in regards to his sexuality and desire to be more than a Faelson. When it comes to the Ratliffs, it would be a satisfying surprise if Saxon is the one to leave Thailand enlightened. Is Jim Rick's dad? There have been plenty of discussions on social media and elsewhere that Jim isn't the man who killed Rick's father, but actually is Rick's father. The key piece of evidence here is Jim's look of recognition when Rick says his mother's name, Gloria Hatchett. That would mean Rick's mom fabricated a story about his dad being murdered by the guy who's really his dad. It's a bit far-fetched, and White seems too savvy a writer to fall back on the old "this person is actually related to this person" trope that pervades a lot of modern storytelling. Isn't this what ultimately tanked the latest Star Wars trilogy? Not everybody needs to be related. When is the White Lotus Season 3 finale? The White Lotus Season 3 finale will be available to stream on Max on Sunday, April 6th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and Pacific Time. There you have it. Who dies in the White Lotus Season 3? Here are our favorite theories ahead of the finale, including a rogue monkey with a gun. It was by Randall Colburn. And personally, I really liked the one about the model girlfriend killing the husband who's responsible for the death of Tanya in Season 2. I hope that's a winner, but I don't have any better guesses than that. I'm going to take a quick break right now to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly magazine, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Next, I have an article from their awardist section, Sterling K. Brown on his journey in paradise, why he thought about his wife for one scene, This Is Us fans, and more. And this article was not marked as having spoilers, but I'll tell you, this is definitely a spoiler alert for the show Paradise. It's a newer show, so if you haven't watched it yet, this reading will take pretty much the rest of the show, and it does give away some pretty big items from the show. Otherwise, please keep listening. It's a good article. The Emmy winner is featured on the awardist digital magazine cover, which also includes early Emmy nomination predictions and more. We won't get to those Emmy predictions this week, but I do have it queued up for next week. Stay tuned on that. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. Sterling K. Brown has found himself on top. This interview is by Jared Hall. Sterling K. Brown is used to keeping secrets from his days on This Is Us, so he's not about to divulge more than he can about the movie he's currently filming in Australia, the live-action version of the 80s anime Voltron. "I can't talk too much," he says, after giving a very short description of the original cartoon on the new episode of the Awardist podcast. When pressed about whether he can say if he's playing a protagonist or an antagonist, he replies with a devilish smile, "I could." The three-time Emmy winner is charming and full of personality as he chats about everything from that big-budget movie to his first Emmy win and how he almost broke character while hosting Saturday Night Live. When the conversation turns to the more serious aspects of his latest series, Hulu's Paradise, or the episodes of This Is Us that fans still want to talk to him about, it's his deep care and honest reflection on characters and story that are just as engaging. In the case of Paradise, created by This Is Us mastermind Dan Fogelman, it's his first time properly leading a series. Playing a Secret Service agent, Xavier Collins, who's still mourning the loss of his wife a few years earlier, and now he's trying to figure out who killed the president, played by James Marsden. Oh, and all of the action is taking place in a manufactured community, an enormous bunker inside a Colorado mountain used to protect thousands from an apocalyptic natural disaster made worse by nuclear panic. Julianne Nicholson's Sinatra is running the show until Xavier figures out her nefarious plans. Here, Brown discusses finally being number one on the call sheet, Xavier's deep emotional turmoil, working with Nicholson and Marsden, This Is Us, and more. The awardist asks, "Aside from this really incredible character that you're playing here," we'll dive more into that in just a second, "I have to mention that this is your first producing role on a series. How'd you get to flex those producing muscles? What did that entail for you?" And Sterling K. Brown responds, "Dan and I are in communication a lot about the casting process. I go into the writer's room. This doesn't feel much different than This Is Us, though, because I would go into the writer's room all the time just to hear them pitch out the whole season. Not for my approval, just because I was curious as to how the sausage is made. And so what I find is when the writers are familiar with who you are and your voice, it's easier for them to incorporate things that may be personal from your own life experience that they can sort of incorporate into the character, etc. So I'm always fascinated by that process." Then, in terms of the casting, that was probably the most exciting part for me, just watching everybody come together. Julianne being available and excited, wanting to come and play in the sandbox. James, similarly. So that's a lot of fun. "I just really value people showing up to work, wanting to be there. So if there's anything that I can do to make sure the environment is one that people not just have to be there, but are excited to be there, then I consider that to be a welcome responsibility of being number one on the call sheet and being a producer." Speaking of being number one on the call sheet, is this the first time for you? First time ever. There are other times in the past in which I've been offered one on the call sheet and I asked to be two or below. It's weird, right? Let me explain that. I was on Army Wives for a number of years, and it was the number one show on Lifetime, like the whole time that it was on. And I was number six or five on the call sheet and something like that. And I was like, okay, we've had success on five or six. On The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, I was number six on the call sheet, and that led to an Emmy. And I was like, 6 isn't so bad. For This Is Us, I think I was number 4 on the call sheet, and I was like, oh, this seems to work out. So I developed this superstition that I don't need to be 1 in the order for things to go well, right? I've been offered a couple of films and the financing fell through when I was number 1 on the call sheet, and they never actually got a chance to come to fruition. And then when Mark Duplass and I did Biosphere, he put me as number 1 on the call sheet, and I said, don't do it. You wrote this movie, you're producing this movie, put me number 2 on the call sheet and it'll be fine. He's like, are you sure? I was like, yes. So when this came up and I read the pilot, I was like, you know what? I'm number 1 on the call sheet. There's no way I could justify not being number 1. So I was like, all right, let me just embrace it and see how it goes. Entertainment Weekly asks, did you feel anything different? He says, I feel like people were looking to me for leadership and I was okay with it. Where other times in the past, I'd been like, we're doing this together. And I still feel as if we do it together. If I'm a leader, I don't think I lead from out front. I lead side by side. Because I've been in an experience in the past where I felt a very clear hierarchy on set and that people did not treat everyone with equal respect. So I wanted to make sure that if I ever got the chance to be number 1, that everybody felt respected and appreciated to be there. So I felt that people were looking to me for that, but I felt because of what I had experienced in the past, I knew what the environment was that I wanted to create, which is, we're all in this together. Let's get into this Xavier Collins. What were your initial perceptions of him in that first script you got? And how did that change as you got into more of Dan's scripts? He is a man in the middle of the grieving process, not through it by any stretch of the imagination, even though it's been 3 years without his wife. And so he's just trying to keep one foot in front of another and put all of his energy into his occupation. He values his occupation, and being good at what he does is important to him. That is something that we have in common. I think that emotionally, not Randall Pearson in that Randall allows his emotions to be very much on the forefront of his being, very much on the surface, I think Xavier tries to keep things a little closer. As a single dad wanting to have a certain appearance of strength for his daughter and his son, doesn't allow himself to feel things as readily. Maybe when he's by himself and he touches the pillow, he misses her when he's by himself, but in front of everybody else, he tries to keep it tight, right? But things unravel a bit. He allows himself the potential of romance, which I think was pretty... They interrupt him to say, did that surprise you? It didn't surprise me, because when Dan pitched it, he talked about how he wanted to try to get me naked in front of people, and I was like, all right. I think it's a thing he likes to do with his number ones. Milo Ventimiglia was naked on the first episode of This Is Us, so he tried to give me a full moon rising in episode 3, but it was one of those things where it was 3 years, and I was like, am I allowed to feel good? He says in episode 3, I don't know if I deserve to be here because you don't realize the cost of everybody. The world ended. What is it that allows me to be here and my wife's not here and all these other people? There's a survivor's remorse that's there, so is he entitled to happiness at all? He has that conversation with his daughter at the carnival right before Billy comes to visit and says, are we allowed to be happy? We've been practicing not doing it for so long. I thought that's what we do now. And she's finding a little bit of romance. I'm finding a little bit of romance at the same time. When you get to 7, which is like the magnum opus of the season, you see him trying to balance 3 balls in the air at the same time. He's trying to take care of the president, he's trying to make sure his wife is able to get to the plane, and make sure that his children are taken care of. And it all just collapses on itself. as the president decides that he needs to be forthright with the public and let them know what's going to happen so they can make a decision on how to use their last time. And Xavier knows immediately S is about to hit the fan. There's no way around it. You cannot control what people do with the information once they have it. Some people will be cool. Some people will not. What I love about him, especially once he gets on Air Force One and he's saying goodbye to his wife and you see the loss, that's the loss he's been carrying with him this whole time. And then the possibility of his wife being alive in the future, he's been trying to figure out how to live without it for 3 years, and now the potential of getting it back exists. It's like, I got to go do that. So I don't know. I love the arc that we were able to create for him during the first season and then propel him into season two. You mentioned episode 7. Holy cow! When you and Juliana Nicholson have that showdown, you're holding the gun, she's on the other end of it. Even though the scene was broken up through the episode, that was filmed as one continuous scene in one day? All one day. That's all one scene because it's at the end of episode 6 into the top of 7 and then bookending 7. Is there a lot of extra mental prep for a scene like that? Yeah, that one felt big, and we knew so much was riding on it. The new information about life existing outside of the bunker, and my wife possibly being alive outside of the bunker. There was a lot riding on it, and this is the first time we're acknowledging the protagonist and the antagonist coming face to face with one another, with fuller knowledge of what each other is capable of. I've already sparked off the sky. I effed with the system. She knows that I can eff with the system, and I know that she's nefarious and has taken out what I believe to be two people. So there was a lot. Even at the beginning of the day, well, Julianne is the most lovely person. I think this is important for the record. It's okay to love Julianne and hate Sinatra. It's okay. Please don't roll up on her in the streets being like, I can't stand you. How dare you hurt Presley? But at the beginning of the day, I said, you know, Julianne, today's going to be a tough one. She's like, yep, I know. And so you do your initial greetings and then you leave each other alone because we both need that space. She's coming from a perspective of like, this is my world. You don't get to F with my world. And he's coming from the perspective of like, you've destroyed everything that's mine and you're not going to destroy it anymore. It was intense. There's a certain level of focus that you maintain on days like that that just requires a little bit more quiet than normal, a little less conversation. It's such a strange profession, Jared. In your mind, you're like, if she does anything that I don't like, I will end her. And that's the level of tension that you're riding with as she's parsing out this new information. And the last bit of information that she gives you is that your daughter is not where you think she is. And you're like, oh, man. And it's funny. Online, I saw people say, like, you should have at least shot her in the knee. You could have done something. And like, there's part of me that's like, I should have shot her in the knee. We also have to talk about your relationship with James Marsden. In that episode in particular, he has quite a moment. But tell me about building this camaraderie, which then crumbles because he has contributed to that grief you talked about. First of all, man, he kills this. He kills Cal Bradford. I knew he was good. I've been watching James my whole life, and then just recently getting the chance to see Jury Duty and whatnot, and how freaking hysterical this guy is. And then he comes and he plays the President of the United States, and he's all charm. And of course, he's handsome, but has such pathos and such warmth and such a desire to do the right thing. You see, two people struggling, someone from a position of power to make the right decision for everybody, as if that's an easy thing to do, and someone just trying to figure out what's the right thing to do for himself and his family. I was just delighted in being in any and every scene with him. He's a good dude. I consider us to be very kindred. He's very open, very honest. You ask him a question, he gives you an answer. So he was easy to know as a person. And I think that translates on screen when people share themselves so readily. There's a camaraderie that just happened. And it's not like we knew each other a long time beforehand, but anytime on set, we're sitting next to each other, we're talking, we're singing songs. I hum a lot. And then I'll start to sing, and then he'll be like, "What are you singing?" And then he leans in and he starts to harmonize. It was like I felt I'd met a brother. It was like hanging out with Justin Hartley. And so it just translated really easily and naturally to a wonderful relationship on screen. It's interesting because I have such empathy for Cal Bradford, and I think the audience, by the time you get to Seven, does as well because they're like, "Come on, Xavier, you can't be blaming him. He told you, don't let her go." Entertainment Weekly says, "But how could Xavier know what he meant?" Yeah, you couldn't know. And I think once you see Seven, everything happened way faster than the president anticipated. I thought we were going to have days. Now all of a sudden it's here. He has such a real and human moment when he speaks to the country. The other scene that got me was you on the phone with your wife, knowing that a nuclear missile is headed toward her in Atlanta. I can't imagine where one goes with a thought like that. It's exactly how you describe it. It's such a strange profession because you have to imagine if the world was about to end and my wife was in a city where a direct nuclear hit was about to transpire, what would that do to you? And it just so happens, this is a shout out to Ryan Michelle Bath, who is my wife, who today, sir, has been married to her husband for 19 years. And I think the two greatest things that an actor has to draw on are their life experience and their imagination. So I have the wonderful life experience of sharing my life with someone whom I adore for 19 years. And I have the faculty of imagination to wonder what life would be like without her. And that's the job, right? And it's such a... And in order for it to land, in order for it to have any real relevance, you just have to sit in that place. And I love my crew because they'd seen it on This Is Us and they'd seen it now. And I'm a gregarious guy. I love to connect with people. But they'll see the moment the brown goes in, you see everybody just walk around me and give me a little bit wider berth and just give me the space and the time necessary to live in that place. And that's what makes them professionals. Is there still a moment or an episode of This Is Us that people want to talk to you about when they see you out and about? Yeah, Memphis, which is episode 116, when William, played by Ron Siffitz Jones, passes away. That one hits hard, right? In the feels. It's funny, we do a podcast, Mandy Moore, myself, and Chris Sullivan, and we're about to discuss episode 214, which is the fire, and we discover how Jack passes away. Entertainment Weekly says, which has a whole different meaning now in LA, especially what Mandy and Milo personally experienced. It's really insane, right? But that one has a deep level of resonance. But what I find is that a lot of them have deep levels of resonance. Different episodes hit different people in different ways, and you have people come up to you all the time, and really what I get asked for more than anything else from This Is Us people, specifically, "Can I have a hug?" And it's the most lovely thing. I think that was the gift of the show. We felt connected, especially in a world that feels so divisive, in a country that feels incredibly divided right now, that we had a show that allowed people to connect. Last thing, Entertainment Weekly says, Would you mind sharing with folks here, as you did at the Q&A I moderated with you, how you obtained that great full moon rising? You're talking about the posterior chain? I give mad credit to Peloton. Shout out to Jess Sims, one of my favorite instructors, because she really likes to put the incline on the treadmill on high, and it just does something. Gravity. It fights against gravity. It lifts. My wife is blessed in the posterior chain as well, and I just don't want her to think that she's the only person that's blessed. We're nearing 50 now, so the fight is real, but Brown's here for a good fight. I'm here. There's a note here that this interview has been edited for clarity and length. We can listen to the full interview with Brown, where he also reveals his secret to getting those tears to sit on the edge of his eyes, what he thought of his wife's TikToks reacting to Paradise, the sketch that nearly made him break when he hosted SNL, what he remembers about his first Emmy win, and more on the Awardist podcast that is linked in the article. That was Sterling K. Brown on his journey in Paradise, why he thought about his wife for one scene, This Is Us fans, and more. It was by the Entertainment Weekly staff, and the interview itself was by Jared Hall. I wasn't kidding when I said there were a few long articles this time, right? We just have a few minutes left. I do have a couple really quick articles coming out of CinemaCon. These are first looks at a couple movies that will be coming later in the year. The first one, Glenn Powell runs for his life, battles Josh Brolin's maniacal TV exec in Intense Running Man, first look. This is by Lauren Huff. Glenn Powell is running, literally, for his life. The intense first look at his new film, The Running Man, debuted at CinemaCon on Thursday and introduced Powell's plucky Ben Richards, the hero of Stephen King's 1982 novel of the same name, written under the pseudonym Richard Bachman. As in the book, the trailer shows Richards becoming a runner on the deranged game show The Running Man, in which contestants must survive for a period of time as murderous stalkers try to hunt them down. The trailer shows Powell jumping down elevator shafts, getting shot at, tossing grenades, and giving the finger to the floating cameras that record his progress for the show's bloodthirsty viewers. We're also introduced to Josh Brolin's villainous TV exec, Dan Killian, and Colman Domingo's flamboyant host, Bobby Thompson. Powell was joined by Brolin, Domingo, and director Edgar Wright on stage to present the footage. "I've never worked harder on any movie in my life," the Top Gun Maverick star told the audience. Powell said he didn't expect to feel like he was actually running for his life while filming, but joked, "That's what he gets for listening to Tom Cruise about doing his own stunts." The story for The New Running Man was co-written by Wright and Michael Bacall, who wrote the script for the director's 2010 film, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. The Running Man was first adapted into a 1987 film set in a dystopian 2019 starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. The New Running Man, which also features William H. Macy, Katie O'Brien, Michael Cera, Sean Hayes, and Lee Pace, among others, is slated to race into theaters on November 7th. That's Glenn Powell runs for his life, battles Josh Brolin's maniacal TV exec in Intense Running Man, first look. It was by Lauren Huff. Watch Liam Neeson murder villains while dressed in a miniskirt in Naked Gun trailer. The new version. The strawberry boxer-wearing actor will play Frank Drebin Jr., the son of the famous lieutenant played by the late actor Leslie Nielsen. This is by Emlyn Travis. It's safe to say that Liam Neeson has mastered the art of disguise in the trailer for the new Naked Gun reboot. In the clip, which was unveiled at CinemaCon and shared online, a sweet, seemingly innocent little schoolgirl can be seen sneaking her way into an active hostage situation before authorities can stop her. When she enters the building, she's confronted by a group of baddies. "What do you want, little one?" a gunman asks her before she suddenly rips off her mask to reveal she's actually Neeson. He then menacingly quips back, "Your ass." The 72-year-old actor then begins sawing down villains left and right using a lollipop while still dressed in his now teeny-tiny schoolgirl ensemble, which has transformed into a tied-up blouse and plaid miniskirt. When one of the rescued hostages asks for his name, Neeson replies, "Frank Draven, Police Squad, the new version." The camera then naturally pans back to reveal Draven in a power pose with his strawberry-themed boxers on full display. Neeson's character is the son of the original Frank Draven, who was played in the beloved comedy franchise by the late Leslie Nielsen. He can be seen playing tribute to his dad, who is described on a plaque as the all-time bad guy catcher in the trailer. "Hi, Daddy, it's me, Frank Jr.," he says. "Love you." He's not alone in honoring his lineage either. An entire collection of officers can be seen weeping in front of their famous relatives' plaques in the clip. That includes Paul Walter Hauser, who is set to play the son of Captain Ed Hocken, who was played by George Kennedy. "Hey, Dad," he adds, "boy, do I miss you." However, there's one officer who will not be receiving his flowers, O.J. Simpson's Officer Nordberg. After briefly cutting to his portrait, another officer can simply be seen shaking his head in response. Written by Dan Greger, Doug Mann, and Lonely Island member Akiva Schaffer, the film features a cast including Pamela Anderson, CCH Pounder, Kevin Durand, Liza Koshy, Cody Rhodes, Eddie Yu, and Danny Houston. The film, which is also directed by Schaffer, is the first Naked Gun installment since the release of 1994's Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult. The Naked Gun explodes into theaters on August 1st. For now, we can watch the trailer that's linked in the article. That was Liam Neeson murdering villains while dressed in a miniskirt in Naked Gun Trailer, the new version, and it was by Emlyn Travis. That uses up all the time we have for the show today. Thank you all for listening. I hope I gave enough of a teaser that we have some Emmy predictions for next week. I'll have that article ready. Until then, I'll say you've been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this has been Entertainment Weekly. I've been reading from their website, which is ew.com. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury, and until next time, goodbye.